Pacifica Podcast, a weekly discussion of current affairs in China, coming to you from the pop-up Chinese studios in Beijing. I'm your host, Kaiser Guo. Joining me today are Kathleen McLaughlin, correspondent for the Bureau of National Affairs. Good to see you again, Kathleen.
Hi, Kaiser.
Stephanie Kleiner-Albrandt, Northeast Asia Project Director of the International Crisis Group. Great to have you back again, Stephanie.
Thank you, Kaiser.
And in his debut appearance on Seneca, Anand Krishnan, China correspondent for The Hindu. Welcome.
Hi, Kaiser. Thanks. Happy to be here.
Yeah, we're really happy to have you here, especially given today's topics. Today, the focus is China's foreign policy, and we'll look at two topics in particular. First, we'll have a bit of an update on the situation on the Korean Peninsula 3 weeks after the shelling of a South Korean-controlled island called Yeonpyeong.
Perfect.
I have such a hard time pronouncing that. I always want to say Pyongyang. Off the western coast of the contested northern limit line, right? Then we're going to delve in some depth into Sino-Indian relations. China's Premier Wen Jiabao began a three-day trip to India today being Wednesday, not Friday when you're listening to this. And that followed on, of course, the completion about 2 weeks ago or so of the 14th round of talks, I believe it was the 14th round, aimed at resolving the longstanding Sino-Indian border dispute. We are fortunate to have people today who can actually speak intelligently about both of these issues. So let's jump right in with North Korea. Stephanie, we had you on the show back in August, I believe it was, talking about the Cheonan incident, and we'd love to hear from you on the state of things now. Last week, State Counselor Dai Bing-guo met with Kim Jong-il in Pyongyang. We are to understand that there was consensus reached after what were described in the Chinese media as candid talks. Does that mean that Pyongyang has been actually sort of brought to heel and told not to inflame the situation any further? Or what can we actually deduce from this?
Well, it's hard to know without having more clarity on what actually was discussed, what China actually said. Certainly, they're not happy about these provocations. Now, in the conventional sphere, after seeing the 2006 and 2009 nuclear tests. But, you know, with regard to China's policy on provocations along the northern limit line, which is this sort of contested boundary between North and South Korea, China's line has pretty much said that – has pretty much been that the North and South were shooting at each other, and it's been a pretty tepid response, pretty much on line with what we saw after the Cheonan, which, you know, the international investigation was deemed by China to be inconclusive and biased. And, you know, the recommendation has been then and since then that the parties need to turn the page and ease tensions through the six-party talks, which China is very keen to get back on track because the six-party talks allowed China a very central role. They didn't necessarily solve the problem, but they didn't put too much pressure on anyone. And if anything ever went wrong, it was quite, you know, it was easy to blame one of the other parties.
So the instinct for a long time has been always, as soon as something goes wrong in North Korea, it's, you know, China needs to help. Let's talk to Beijing. That seems to be changing. China obviously has not been as willing to be helpful, at least from the South Korean and American perspective, as perhaps it was in the past. So has this changed the way that Japan, South Korea, and the United States approach the whole DPRK problem?
Yeah, definitely. I mean, we've seen a definite change in the approach, particularly now since the Cheonan, which really – the Cheonan really strained Chinese relations with South Korea to a very severe degree and also with the U.S. and Japan. So what you've seen now is the U.S., Japan, and Korea, South Korea, are intensifying their condemnatory stances vis-a-vis Pyongyang and essentially excluding China from discussion on next steps, right? And one can almost call this like a trifecta. So it's, you know, rejecting China's call for emergency consultations. Uh-huh. You know, China tried to call for these emergency consultations, which technically were not the six-party talks, which I think China wanted to call in order to get around the conditions that South Korea and the U.S. have put on six-party talks.
So what's Beijing's reaction been to being sort of left out of this now, this new, what you describe as a trifecta, the Japanese, the South Koreans, and the Americans now sort of talking directly now with or dealing with each other and bypassing China? Has Beijing had any kind of reaction to this?
Well, I mean, it is very serious because this is really a widening of the gap between the two camps. And although these discussions and exercises are directed at the DPRK, they're really seen in Beijing as a serious threat to its regional security and also, yeah. frankly, an unwelcome source of domestic pressure for China. So what's happened is China has, in a way, transformed the threat perception from being, you know, one of unpredictable moves by North Korea into one of the U.S. coming in, strengthening its security alliances, you know, driving increased South Korean and Japanese military deployment. Mm-hmm. And it must be concerned because, frankly, all these countries are now strengthening their own missile defense systems, and this intensifies the risk of a regional arms race.
Now they're going to conduct exercises on the western side of the peninsula again. How's China responding to this?
No, I mean, China is very, very upset about all of this response. It doesn't see this conventional escalation as really a threat to its own security. It's mostly concerned about, you know, stability on the Korean Peninsula and, frankly, keeping the presence and the role of the U.S. military in the region from increasing. Those are two of its really top. Sure. So anything where the U.S. comes into the region is profoundly disturbing.
Especially if it's on the near side of the peninsula.
Yeah, of course, the closer, the worse. But they made a big deal out of the, you know, the American response to the Cheonan as well, and that the similar thing is happening now.
Kathleen, did you read this editorial I sent around a couple of weeks ago? I don't know if you saw this thing. There's a guy by the name of Brett Stevens who is a frequent op-ed writer on the Wall Street Journal, and he wrote something with a very provocative title called China Joins the Axis of Evil. I don't know if any of you guys saw this piece.
Yeah, I saw it. I mean, I guess his conclusion was something that people were probably thinking, but he certainly didn't seem to prove anything.
Right, what Hecker found, the uranium enrichment facility, he thinks that there's sort of a smoking gun that says it was built with Chinese help.
Right, and to me, I don't see a smoking gun in the piece anywhere. It seems something that was
sort
intended
of process
to be
of illumination
provocative.
More, right?
Yeah.
It wasn't a QCon, it wasn't this, and it wasn't... Yeah.
But the issue still remains. How much priority does China put on denuclearization? That's really the goal of the article was to, I mean, it was trying to point at China's cooperation on helping North Korea get nuclear technology. And I think then we can look at the fact that China prioritizes stability over denuclearization. China's most worried about, you know, DPRK political and economic stability. And in the times in the past when China's been able to, has engaged in sort of criticizing North Korea on nuclear issues, it negotiated hard to weaken those resolutions, and enforcement's always remained a challenge. So, yeah. So, I mean, generally, non-proliferation
with Iran,
is not the
right?
top of, right. yeah, the top of China's agenda.
Delay and weaken. It's always been sort of the delay and weaken approach.
That's right, yeah.
I mean, but you're describing is a Beijing that's interested in maintaining sort of stability on the peninsula, status quo, if you will. I mean, that's not what the author of this, he writes,
oh, okay.
This is not the behavior of a status quo power, but of a revolutionary one, supporting activities and regimes that represent the most acute threat to global security. If it continues unchecked, it is China that should be sanctioned and the North Korea, or and the North's facilities destroyed. This is Brad Stevens. Kind of cuckoo, if you ask me, but...
Yeah, I'm not familiar with his other work, but it's a little bit over the top. I mean,
yeah,
I think Stephanie's point is a lot more reasonable and has evidence to back it up. This piece is a little... I don't want to say off. Yeah.
And it's not like it's coming out of left field. I mean, China has really strengthened its relationship with North Korea over the last year, and particularly in recent months. I mean, we've seen a record number of high-level...
Visits. Sure.
Really, the most since we've seen since the Cold War. We've seen, you know, major economic support, you know, deepening of cooperation, et cetera. And, you know, China has separated out to a certain extent its bilateral relationship with North Korea from these tricky issues that are really seen as the U.S.'s issues.
I really didn't want to bring up WikiLeaks again this week, but
oh, no.
I just had to ask you about you know, the one memo that suggested that China was ready for a unified Korea, unified, you know, ruled from
South
from,
Korean
from, yeah,
wishful
from
thinking. It's all
say.
South
Korean wishful thinking. Okay. Let's move on now to our next topic, to Sino-Indian relations. And let me reintroduce Anant Krishnan from The Hindu. Anant, how long have you been reporting from China now?
It's been almost 2 years now.
Okay, so. Just 2 years. Where were you stationed before that?
I was in India for several years with the same newspaper in Chennai in the south and in Mumbai.
Okay. So there are, of course, a huge number of dimensions to the whole Sino-Indian relationship, spanning border issues, to India's hosting the Dalai Lama and the exile community in Dharamsala, China's very close relationship for a long time with Pakistan, the nuclear deal with the U.S., of course, is important. The list goes on and on. But we'll try to touch on a lot of this in the next half hour or so. But let's start with the border. Long border, anywhere from, it's contested. Even the length
Nobody
of it
knows
is contested.
The length,
right, the length of the border is anywhere from 2,000.
Actually, it was funny because it was mentioned the Indians say 4,000 kilometers. And the Global Times had an interview yesterday with the Indian ambassador to China who said 4,000 kilometers. And then right in the middle of the interview was a two-paragraph long editor's note which says China would like to stress that we don't know it's 4,000 kilometers. So even from the distance, it's something that's a point of contention.
If there's anything, indication of just how contested it really is. But let's try to give our listeners an overview of the border issue, some historical context. I think a lot of people don't know, Aksai Chin from a hole in the ground or Arunachal Pradesh. So let's talk a little bit about where all these issues arose from. History lesson.
Yeah, essentially to break it down, there are two sections of the border that are disputed. One's on the west, and which is Aksai Chin, which is in between Xinjiang and Tibet and Kashmir. And on the east is Arunachal Pradesh, which is currently a state that's administered by India. So these are essentially...
But called South Tibet by the...
Called Southern Tibet, for the last about...
Well, I think it's been about 15 years.
Part
of it. Not the entire state of Arunachal Pradesh.
A big part of it is called Southern Tibet. So essentially these are the two sections of the border that the two countries have claims on. China has claims, is currently occupied Aksai Chin, and India currently administers Arunachal Pradesh. So for the longest time, the obvious solution was, why don't you just swap the two sections?
That's what I've always thought.
Which is actually something that the Chinese suggested in the 50s, but India didn't accept that. And then in 1962, you had a brief war between the two countries. And ever since 62, it's pretty much been a handcuff in terms of pushing negotiations forward. So so we actually did not have any talks until the late 80s. So it's only been in the last decade that the two sides have actually set up like a formal mechanism to discuss arriving at a settlement.
What happened in the late 80s? I mean, I was here as a student in 1988 when Rajiv Gandhi came to Beijing. And I actually met the First Lady briefly, all places, on the Antique Street, Liu Lichang. Very strange.
Just randomly?
Randomly. Well, I saw this gigantic entourage, and I sort of pressed up to the front, and me and this American guy, and I just kind of muscled my way through.
They didn't
and just
have very
hands.
Good security, I guess.
And there was this whole sort of, Sini Hindi bye-bye spirit going on.
Actually, that was the visit that kind of brought the relationship out of cold storage. I think from 62 to 88, you had very little in the way of...
No prime ministers.
Nothing. Yeah, no prime ministers, nothing. So 88 was a turning point, and that was when the two countries said, "We border issue is complicated, we can't solve it, so we'll just, put this in the back burner and try working on other aspects of the relationship."
Right. And then what happened? What went so sour? I mean, not until 2003 did things sort of start to warm again. What was the Sino-Indian relationship like between 1988 and say 2003?
You did have political exchanges and diplomatic engagement, but it was in some sense conscious policy, because when you've had 25 years of no relations, you don't start with trying to address the border dispute. You first try to build a sense of trust by working on trade and other issues. So I think in the last decade and a half, one of the biggest signs of progress has been trade. So, which is actually also the focus in Wen Jiabao's visit. And part of the reason is just that both countries kind of came to a consensus that let's not work on issues that there's no realistic chance of solving.
So by volume, it's enormous. I mean, it's now $60 billion, so it's like it's grown enormously. I saw a statistic somewhere that said that it's 230 times larger than it was in 1990.
I mean, it was I think $1 or $2 billion maybe in at the turn of the last decade.
So just in this decade, it's just
and actually,
really skyrocketed six times.
Not many people are aware that China is India's biggest trade partner. So
wow.
So it's
yeah.
Now, what is the nature?
Billion? $60 billion.
$60 billion. Yeah. What is the nature of the trade, though? How would you describe what?
Yeah, I think actually the two governments like to stress the $60 billion, but once you actually look under the bonnet, it's not as impressive as it sounds, because it's one of the big points of contention is it's heavily skewed in China's favor. So the deficit's going to be $19 billion.
Wow.
This year, which is out of $60 billion, is a huge chunk.
Yeah.
And
absolutely.
India pretty much exports raw materials, iron ore, and yeah. imports finished goods. So some Indian commentators have said, you know, this is a relationship that it's like a neo-colonial kind of relationship.
The
in terms
Indians
of the quality
said that they export plastic pellets to China to make buckets, and they re-import the buckets into India.
Because it's true, because it's cheaper. So because
yeah.
and that's partly India's fault in the sense that you don't have infrastructure. So for Indian companies, it makes sense to actually get it done in China and ship it rather than waiting for the Indian government to build a road. So it's some truth to that. So.
The sort of people-to-people relationship between India and China, recent like so many other people-to-people relationships, has sort of taken a strange turn because of the internet, because they are now able to sort of see what one another are saying about each other online, and it's taken a decided turn for the worse, I
yeah.
would imagine.
But you do, as you probably know, you do kind of get the extreme. I mean, the voice of the mainstream is rarely represented fairly online. You usually tend to get, especially in China, you'd get the hyper-nationalist
but
comments.
In
India,
India
too.
For sure,
so,
the strategic
too,
community
right.
is hyperventilating about
sure.
China. And the funny thing is that when China and India come together, like they did in Copenhagen, when China came to India and said, look, help us, and the Indians said, okay,
right.
and they were quite flattered that they came to India to do all of the negative, like the internet stuff turned off almost overnight.
Yeah.
So
very interesting.
Yeah.
I hadn't actually noticed that. That's very
yeah.
interesting.
Yeah, yeah. A lot of the criticism turned off.
I mean, they say, I mean, one of the ways I would characterize the relationship is there's just a terrible imbalance in the level of give a f- where the Indian intellectual community sort of obsesses on China.
That's changing,
sure.
Kaiser, now because of the U.S. reentering, in a way, the equation. I mean, the Indians have always cared more about worried more about China than vice versa.
Sure.
But now that Obama went to India,
sorry,
China
that,
is
it was
much
the nuclear
more
deal with Bush too, right?
But that's it's changing things a little bit. China's now it's worried. China's, you know, looking at India as a rising power,
mm-hmm.
You know, a power that the U.S. Is now, you know, they think that the U.S. is approaching and putting more emphasis on the relationship. So, you know, that's what's interesting about this visit. It comes so quickly on the heels of Obama's
right.
visit, right?
That's right, that's right.
And you have these things like, you know, Reliance doing deals with General
right.
Electric, and those are eclipsed, right, by the deals being done with Shanghai Electric.
For sure, and it's
yeah,
a completely
yeah.
new trend.
Yeah.
We've never seen that before.
Yeah.
But I think Stephanie's right in the sense that now it's the U.S., but one of the things is for the last 3 decades, it's never been a relationship of two countries. You've always had a very influential sort of a third presence. You had the Soviet Union, and then that changed when the Soviet
yeah.
Union was allied with India and had tensions with China. And now
yeah.
I think the U.S. and Pakistan factor is something that's not going to go away. And for me,
yeah.
probably it'll be one of the biggest sources of mistrust.
Sure. So let's talk about that specifically. Yeah. You know, as we've said, President Obama was recently in India, and it was actually the longest state trip he's made abroad to South Asia, which was symbolic probably in its own way, and very much sort of driven home in the American media. From Beijing's point of view, there was clearly some sort of a containing China subtext to the visit, an unwelcome continuation of the policies of Bush 43.
Right.
I mean, does Washington just see New Delhi as something, I mean, as just a sort of democratic counterweight to a rising China? Is that how, and what's India's sense of being played in that?
I think definitely especially with the Bush administration, it was kind of a mutual sort of feeling in the sense that Bush was extraordinarily popular in India,
mm-hmm.
and he pushed forward the nuclear deal with consequences that are still being debated. But now it's slightly different in the sense that the U.S. very much likes to, when you have presidential visits, the U.S. tends to speak of where, you know, a rising India and there's undertones of a counterweight. But I think the Indian government doesn't buy that as much now, because U.S., of course, also has a huge relationship with Pakistan and sells fighter jets to Pakistan. So, I mean, those kind of equations figure too. And I think, as Stephanie mentioned, the whole climate change angle. I think
not only climate change, they cooperate on trade international
Doha.
So I think the Indian government probably sees it's in its interest to, when it comes to usually for multilateral issues where its interests kind of lie with China, given that they're large developing countries, the Indian government is increasingly prepared to, upset the Americans, which is something you didn't see as well.
It's in a very good position to play pivot in the sort of three-player game.
For sure.
In any three-player game, the most enviable position is one where you have sort of two mutual antagonists who are courting you, and India is in a very good position actually to assume that spot.
India is warily watching China's increasing presence, particularly in the Indian Ocean.
Right.
And they're engaging in a strategy whereby they recognize they can't get involved in classic containment policy because it's too late for that. But they know that they need to increase defense spending and maintain, their slight edge in naval presence, develop linkages with major players in the region with shared concerns about China, and frankly, help give countries space when dealing with China. So they've got a whole strategy. I mean, they're playing it in the way that best suits their interests, whether it be with the U.S. or China on these issues.
Wouldn't you say that India's best shot at gaining a permanent seat on the Security Council at this point would be to distance itself from the U.S.?
It's funny that you bring that up, because
that was going to come up.
I'm glad it did, because even though the U.N. Security Council reforms is something that's probably, you're talking about, no one knows when it's going to materialize, but the Indian government sort of made it a crucial pillar in its foreign policy, and it does remain a sore point that of the five permanent members, China is the only one that hasn't voiced explicit support for an Indian bid. So that's something that the Indians bring up. I think they even brought it up this week and last week in the talks leading up to the UN visit. And
it's Chinese very symbolic,
It's symbolic, but what didn't help us, if we can bring up WikiLeaks again, was you had
last time.
No, what didn't help was you had He Yafei actually. Going on record, according to American diplomats, let's be fair.
Sure.
Going on record saying, telling the Americans, why are you, pushing reforms forward? It's not in your interest. It's not my interest. Let's stall this. So that was noticed in India. So.
Yep. Very, very interesting. And I mean, that piece seemed kind of believable to me.
For sure.
there was a really interesting piece, though. I think you sent it to me, Anant, by somebody from your paper, a columnist, Siddharth. Varadarajan. He wrote, American attitudes toward Beijing appear to have become a better predictor of temperature on the Indo-US front than anything intrinsic to the bilateral relationship. So it's like they're simply a function of U.S.-China relations, which is interesting. Now, if that is the case, and it seems to me pretty obviously to be the case, can't Beijing kind of be excused for seeing it this way? I mean, How is Beijing ever going to buckle on this issue of say the UN Security Council?
No, for sure. Yeah. I think in India we usually try to see things from the Chinese point of view. But being here and speaking to Chinese officials and analysts, it's very clear that there is a sense increasingly. And I think Wen Jiabao's last visit to India, 2005, was a visit where this kind of Wen sort of took this step to saying, he gave a concession on the territorial dispute and things like that. And it was seen as a huge landmark visit. And China said, we want a strategic relationship with you and things like that. And a few months later was when India and the U.S. started moving this nuclear deal along. So in China, that was seen as a slap in the face in the sense that we've actually reached out to you, and this is a Chinese viewpoint here. So
and that's fed, of course.
For
The current go ahead really in China with this deal with Chashma 3 and 4, these Pakistani
five,
nuclear deals. And 5, it's a strategic tit for tat, essentially.
Right. You're going to help arm India, we're going to help arm Pakistan.
Two wrongs make a right.
that's something being debated in them. In America now, people are questioning the Indian-American nuclear deal. And
we don't have to question now, and many of us were questioning it from the very beginning.
But I think that, to be fair, though, I think it's not entirely fair in the sense that the Indo-US deal was a very long-drawn process that You know, India kind of had to jump through hoops of fire and take all a range of commitments. But now the China-Pakistan deal is pretty much going along with, you know, none of the formalities.
No, the U.S. made major efforts to push it through the nuclear supplier group. Right. Mm. And China is trying to claim, well, first, it probably knows that it doesn't have much of a chance going through nuclear supplier group. Ireland was surprisingly the one that sort of took them to task in New Zealand. But, you know, they've decided that they're trying to grandfather, you know, they're trying to say that their current nuclear deals are part of an earlier
one.
Right. Yeah. But the other thing is you have to compare the nuclear non-proliferation or proliferation records of India and Pakistan.
Sure.
And there's just – they're night and day. And then you have to look at the sort of, you know, the increasing instability in Pakistan and worry about what happens if terrorists get their hands on these weapons. So there's, you know, it's not excusing the U.S. civilian nuclear deal, because that, you know, giving nuclear technology to a non-NPT state is still seen as inimical.
But I think, as you said, it also, even with North Korea and other issues, as you said, well, let's not get too sidetracked, but I think there's a sense, generally you get a sense, speaking in China, doesn't have too much time or patience for a lot of internationally mandated rules, whether it comes to proliferation. So I don't think there's too much concern here about bypassing the NSG or, you know. But I think we should mention
this. Well, because, at the end of the day, the problem is that the Americans and others aren't taking them to task over it, because they're frankly worried about they're worried about their relations with Pakistan. They're worried about keeping their military, you know, their ties, the cooperation they need.
Sure. I mean, it's very, very important to keep, especially right now, the situation in Afghanistan.
Yeah.
Let's talk a little bit about the 14th round of talks that took place last month. India's special representative, Shiv Shankar Menon, met with State Counselor Daibingwal. The guy's been very busy, Daibingwal.
Oh, yeah.
What were the atmospherics like around that?
Yeah, I actually met Mr. Menon right after the talks, and he came out of it pretty positive. And up until the 13th round, they were essentially talking about talking, which is the first of three stages. Now they've actually moved on to the second stage, which is agreeing a framework, which is the nuts and bolts of who concedes where. So this is something that's, I don't know, might go on for another 20, 30 rounds. I don't know. I'm not holding my breath. But what he said was the most important thing was it's under control, in the sense that it's an extremely peaceful border. Mm-hmm. And one of the things that's often ignored, it's probably, I don't know, Stephanie, it's probably China's most peaceful border. Even with North Korea, they've had incidents. Myanmar, they have incidents. Kyrgyzstan. But there haven't been incidents.
No shooting incidents since 69, I believe.
Not in a long time.
Right.
So
yeah.
They do have these, what they call border incursions, because they have overlapping claim
because
lines.
Because there's a 10. It's
well, it's so, drawn with a thick nib, as somebody written The Economist wrote.
Yeah, and it was a huge, actually it became an issue in India last year, because you had a lot of media reports that were leaking from the military saying the Chinese are patrolling in a more aggressive way.
Yeah.
But both governments didn't give too much credence to that.
Oh, I mean, there's certainly been an Indian military buildup as well, right?
Professionalization.
Right, 100,000 troops right now in Arunachal Pradesh.
Yeah, I actually asked Menon about this, and what he said. He said, well, they're both doing it. I mean, the Chinese are doing it. They have an Air Force base in Tibet.
Yeah.
They're building highways and railway lines. The Indians are doing it. They're both doing it. But as he said, I mean, it's something they can do what they want to do. We can do what we want to do.
And the fact that it was followed up so quickly with Wynne's visit, I mean, what's the punditry in India saying about that fact, about Wynne's visit?
Much of the focus, I think a huge amount of the focus is purely on the business, because I think we should mention that he's bringing 400 businessmen, 400 Chinese.
Which is big in the Chinese media. They keep keying on the 400 businessmen.
400, yeah. And I think it's the biggest ever trade delegation. And I think part of the reason is because, I mean, there's nothing else to talk about. I mean, you aren't going to have a landmark in terms of the border or UN Security Council.
Well, of course, there's the issue of the stapled visas.
That's another thing.
There have been three non-stapled visas issued recently. Did you hear that?
No, really? But it's impossible.
Wait. Let's help our listeners to understand what the hell this issue is about.
What is a stapled visa?
Okay, essentially, I think it's been about 2 years since the Chinese have for Indian citizens from the state of Jammu and Kashmir. What the Chinese embassy has been doing is, instead of stamping the visa in the passport, they attach a sheet of paper which kind of is in a way questioning.
They do that when you go to North Korea, for example.
Yeah.
So you can never claim you were there.
Yeah. Yeah. That's part of the reason. The way the Indian government sees it is that China is questioning Indian sovereignty over the state. And the real sore point is that they don't do it for Pakistanis from the Pakistani,
from the Pakistani side of Kashmir.
So that's the real sore point. Because, no, and it is important in the sense that for almost two decades now, China has, for all its closeness with Pakistan, hasn't interfered in Kashmir. And it said, you know, we'd be neutral. So we'll shift away from that is something that, I mean, it's a pretty
it's
big
significant,
deal.
Right? So it's not as frivolous as it seems.
And the Indians have, to, you know, talk about the reaction. It was a very strong reaction on the Indian side with a cancellation of a defense.
Yeah, what happened was shortly after, this was in July, an Indian army chief from the Northern Command, which includes Kashmir, was supposed to come on a defense exchange. And the Chinese said, we can't give him a visa. So for because it was a military general and things like that, there was a huge reaction to that in India. And they actually have stopped defense exchanges and still suspended.
I'm curious, I mean, not at a sort of state-to-state level or even really at a people-to-people level at this point. I'm curious what it's like for you, your experience here. I mean, Smoke and Mirrors is a terrific book.
Right.
Have you had experiences similar to the author's? I'm sorry, I know her.
She's now written about two cats.
She's actually my predecessor here. She was here for about 5 or 6 years.
Yeah. Right.
So, no, for sure. I identify with the theme that runs through the book is the sense that for two countries that are neighbors and have so many things in common, you have all these experiences where you're stunned at the fact that they know so little about each other.
Right.
Just from, you know, from the man on the street, which is something that... Which I think they need to work on in the sense that India has far more exchanges with the U.S., Europe, than with China. So it's understandable in that sense.
I mean, Chinese ignorance of India just knows no bounds. It's unbelievable.
It kind of works both ways. I mean,
Yeah.
I mean, speaking of people in India, they kind of also have a skewed sort of image of communist China with a capital C.
Yeah.
So I mean, people were shocked.
Well, they do like George
churches,
Bush.
People have no idea.
Well, coming to you from communist China, I think that's all we've got time for today. I want to thank you guys all for coming. Thanks, Stephanie. Thanks, Kathleen. And thanks very much. We're definitely going to have you on again. Yeah, I'm really looking forward to reading more. Let's just remind everyone how busy you've been with... so much going on with the WIN visit, of course, and so for taking time out of your busy schedule to join us here, thanks very much.
Well, happy to be here.
So we'll see you guys again next week with more from Seneca Podcast. Take care.